I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're thinking about it, chances are we're talking about it on WHYY's Radio Times.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice.
Good morning, I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. Philadelphia had the dubious distinction of being the last large American city that did not have public access cable TV. Well, not anymore. After more than two decades, an agreement has been reached between the city, Comcast, and the Philadelphia Community Access Coalition. The next stop is City Council. A nonprofit will be formed, and soon there will be five community channels available to cover a range of topics. Gretchen Clausing joins us in this first portion of Radio Times, co-founder of the Philadelphia Community Access Coalition. That's a grassroots group that's been working since 1997 to get public access for Philadelphia. She works as a program director at Scribe Video. And Gretchen Clausing, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times. Good morning.
It's great to be back. Thank you.
You're welcome. And to the listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. So have you popped the champagne corks yet?
Well, not yet. I think I'm going to probably be ready to do that when the channels actually go live. Then I'll feel like it's really happening.
It's been a long time coming. Your group involved in this for 10 years, but
yes,
it really goes back some 15 years before that.
Actually, even longer. It goes back to 1983, so almost 25 years, mm-hmm, when the initial franchise agreements were signed between the cable companies and the city of Philadelphia.
And we could do a whole book on this, but why did it take so long?
Oh, a lot of people ask that question. I mean, I think it's definitely the question. Cable came late to Philadelphia in terms of looking around the rest of the country, and they took a lot of time creating a really interesting plan, and all of that was written into the city ordinance. And then I just think it was a question of a lack of political will at that particular time, a city in a financially challenged, and, you know, again, just other more important things. And I think it was just sort of there were many early activists, some of them that were actually at the press conference last week, who had been fighting this back in the 80s. And so, you know, again, it was just a question of, you know, political will, and I think in some degree, various groups of activists just getting tired, and so every few years a new group would come up, and we just happened to get started in 97 when the franchise agreements were coming up to be renegotiated, and we were just concerned that the provision for public access was going to be eliminated. And we thought it was going to be really pretty simple. You know, we would go in with a group of community folks and we would make the case and it would happen. And 10 years later.
Well, your group, one of the things that your group did, and we should say we're talking about four administrations here in Philadelphia, one of the things your group did was to file a lawsuit. How effective do you think that was to get people down to the table and really talking?
Well, our initial lawsuit wasn't incredibly successful because it actually got thrown out, you know, for lack of standing. But as a result, we were working with our attorneys, and it got us to a point where we ended up in sort of a court-mandated mediation with a group from the city. And it was sort of at that point where we began this really interesting process of, I think, the city getting to know us as activists, mm-hmm, and us beginning to gain confidence in our city officials that they were actually committed to this process. And we then, over the years, began to see definite commitment on the part of the city in seeing this happen.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's an interesting sort of shift, I guess, of alliances, and the people sitting across the table from you all of a sudden not necessarily the enemy anymore.
No, exactly. And again, it was really exciting for us to see, especially when we went and did a presentation for the mayor, to see the folks from public property and the managing director's office and, you know, the finance department and everyone who would become really quite knowledgeable and real experts in it, and sort of getting excited and wanting to sort of see this happen. So to feel that investment, you know, was really rewarding.
Now the next stop is City Council.
Next
has
stop
to get
City
voted
Council.
On.
Yeah, because there's been some changes that have been made. There, as part of this, what's going to happen is a nonprofit will be set up, which will be the Philadelphia Access, you know, corporation, and it will run the center, and all the money from now just Comcast, which is the only cable provider in the city, will go directly to the nonprofit, mm-hmm, and they'll administer everything. And back in the 1983 agreements, there was money set aside for central facility and then satellite facilities in the different cable franchise areas, but those are 1983 dollars, and that wouldn't be enough to fulfill that same plan. So now it's all being put into a central facility, and that needs to be, that money needs to be consolidated. And so that change needs to be voted on by city council.
And this central facility, an empty library at this point, sitting at 25th and Lehigh in North Philadelphia.
That was part of this, these conversations and the negotiations with the city, that they actually came to us and proposed a building, which is really exciting because, again, the $2.7 million wouldn't be enough to build, you know, new construction. And it's a really, you know, fantastic Art Deco library in a neighborhood that's going through a ton of redevelopment, and I think it's going to be a great place and a great thing for the neighborhood.
Now, this idea goes back to the early 1980s, before there was YouTube, before there was the internet, before there were many technologies that really allow people a kind of public access for themselves. Does that get you to rethink how public access will work in Philadelphia because of all the things that have been happening on the internet?
Well, I think that's the thing that's kind of exciting about starting up this center now. And you can sort of look at ways that, you know, I think YouTube and all those things are really exciting in terms of ways of distribution. But still, the thing about public access, a main thing about it is getting people together and sort of having that more, you know, kind of community experience of working on programming together and having getting together, you know, and having the training and all those other aspects to it. But what I do think is exciting is that with the way things, media is kind of converging, you know, there will be many other opportunities beyond just the cable cast of the programming for people to be able to access it. So a program that might only, you know, have a viewership at a particular time can now maybe pick up viewers. Part of the new deal with Comcast is that will have 4 hours on their video on demand system. So for some of the more important programming, more popular programs, they can be accessible whenever people want to see them on video on demand.
And we're talking about five channels at some point once everything is up and running.
Yeah, we'll be getting our first channel once the access corporation, the nonprofit, is set up, is channel 66. And then we also get at the same time, that's an analog channel, and then we'll be getting a digital channel at that same time. And then as more original programming, locally produced original programming, is produced and we begin to sort of fill up the channels, then we will go to Comcast and they'll release future digital channels.
Let's say me and my neighbors, my neighbors are interested in doing some kind of a program. How does that work? I mean, if a community group is interested in producing a program, what are the steps?
Well, in the short term, right now, because there's no facility, what we're in the process of doing is just putting a call out there for anyone who has programming already. I mean, I just know from my experience at Scribe Video that there are so many, you know, nonprofit organizations that have been making films, independent filmmakers. There's certainly tons of programming out there. So we're sort of helping the city right now in beginning to accumulate, you know, that programming so that by the end of the year, hopefully we will have some amount of programming up on Channel 66. But then once the Access Corporation is set up, the request will be for everyone to become a member of the station, and that you would go through some kind of a, you know, introductory training, orientation to the channel, and probably like some media literacy training. And then depending upon if you need technical training, you would do that. But it's pretty much just coming and going through that process. Again, I don't know what the timeline is going to be for that in terms of when the center is going to be actually up and running. But I think in the short term, the hope would be to be working with, you know, citywide partners. Because again, what's different than 25 years ago is that there are so many places that have production equipment that I think we can be tapped into to be kind of partners in this effort.
Are there any issues, any topics that are just not going to be allowed on public access cable TV?
Well, I think this is where we look to our peers across the country and sort of see how they do this. I mean, the great thing about it is that it's there for people to be able to express their points of views, and we would of course be following, you know, the laws that are set forth in terms of, you know, decency and obscenity. But then there's also, you know, just looking at guidelines and again hoping that, you know, good programming is, you know, generally always in abundance, and, you know, you hope that people will feel invested in the station, and, you know, that's how you deal with these challenges. I think that's always been the bugaboo that comes up and people talk about and say, well, what about if there's unpopular views or things that people are going to find offensive, and I feel like that the Access Corporation will. And I think this is what's important, is that it's made up of because everyone's a member and because everyone does have the opportunity to vote on the board of directors, and that it really is about getting people that are invested in the station and not wanting to kind of do anything that would put it into any jeopardy.
But there is a place for unpopular views. Definitely. And I would think a place on cable access.
Definitely. And I mean, that's the point, you know, that's exactly. The point of being able to have those, you know, diverging points of view, you know, have their place.
And is the idea to grow a big audience, or do you see this almost as kind of niche programming?
Well, I think that the viewer statistics always, you know, there is always this, you know, perception that people don't watch, but it's interesting. I forget even where I was. Actually, not too long. We were at a town hall. I was at a town hall on kind of the creative economy and kind of arts in Philadelphia. And there was a woman who was here from Denver, and they have a pretty established access system there. And she was saying that she's always amazed at how many people tell her that they've seen her when she's on public access television. So yes, I mean, we obviously, you know, the hope is that people are going to watch. But ultimately, it really, again, it goes back to just giving people the opportunity to kind of create their program and have that experience. And get that training in technology.
And we're talking about there's youth programming. I know there are certain categories that are part of this agreement.
Well, what we went to this, you know, managing director and the mayor with back about a year and a half ago was sort of looking at kind of a vision for the channels and why five channels and how we could use the five channels. And we were, again, looking at what's successful around the country, and there's a really tremendous network of youth media.
Mm-hmm.
And there's actually these youth channels that are youth-run, and so that would be something that we would want to see the Access Corporation build towards. And then there's also, you know, many faith-based organizations are sort of huge supporters of public access television, so definitely sort of seeing that as a niche. Obviously, all the nonprofits in Philadelphia would have an opportunity to access the channel for doing their, you know, we see it as being a great place for education and for, you know, sharing of information, so they would be using that. And then there's just obviously arts and culture.
Sure.
I mean,
sure.
Again, could easily see many of the groups here in Philadelphia occupying a channel just devoted to arts and culture. And then just your typical, you know, I have a show that I want to do. You know, you're sort of the individual kind of coming, and then that could also take up a whole other channel. So we see it obviously not going to be happening right away, but something that we would build up towards.
And what's the rollout for these various channels then?
Well, again, technology is so different. The hope is that by the end of the year, there would actually be a series of servers that would be sort of, for the time being, housed next to the government channel servers in City Hall that would begin programming. And that's how we would be able to start getting things out. And then probably it's going to take at least a year, right, 2.5 years to get the center up and running. But I would think that at least kind of introductory orientations and trainings and for folks that already potentially have some access to equipment could begin producing. And, you know, so hopefully sometime in 2008.
Well, very exciting. Congratulations to you and your group for hanging in there.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And that's Gretchen Clausing, co-founder of the Philadelphia Community Access Coalition. That's a grassroots group that's been working since 1997 to get public access cable TV in Philadelphia, and looks like it's a done deal. And she works as a program director at Scribe Video. Coming up, we'll be talking about a new wrinkle in the immigration debate. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The MBA program at Temple University's Fox School of Business supports WHYY. The Fox School is hosting MBA for an Evening on Wednesday, October 10th. It's an opportunity to meet the staff, to sample MBA classes with faculty, and to engage MBA students with questions. Registration for the Wednesday, October 10th MBA for an Evening is available online at fox.temple.edu. That's fox.temple.edu.
In 1957, a Little Rock High School was being integrated. Arkansas's governor called on the National Guard to keep the peace. Turns out he ordered up some trouble, too.
It was an orchestrated show.
So you're saying you, at the behest of Governor Faubus, got the crowd out there?
I got some of the crowd out.
Seeing politics in black and white, next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY. When discussing post-traumatic stress disorder in soldiers, experts usually refer to soldiers who fought in Vietnam or the Iraq War. But what about World War II vets? Did they suffer less because they fought a different war and were considered heroes when they returned home? Join Dan Gottlieb for the next Voices in the Family when we'll examine PTSD in World War II vets and hear personal accounts from veterans. Today at noon on WHYY 91 FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Excuse me, I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Earlier this year, Congress debated an immigration bill that would have created a path to legalization for millions of immigrants living in the country illegally. Well, that bill went nowhere, and now Senator Richard Durbin is going to introduce a bill that would allow the children of undocumented immigrants to become citizens through military service or college. We're joined now by Michelle Mittelstadt, and she covers immigration policy and Congress for the Houston Chronicle. Michelle, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times. Good morning.
Good morning, Marty. Good to be with you.
Nice to have you with us. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Michelle, before we talk about Durbin's bill, let's roll the clock back a couple of months. Whatever happened to that immigration reform bill of last spring?
Well, it imploded dramatically, I think, as most people know, last June, at the end of June, after a long and very contentious debate, and it seemed like they really were very close to getting something done, and in the end, it just fell apart amid so much opposition and criticism, and the fact that the bill was really not endorsed by, even the people who were endorsing the bill weren't in love with most aspects of it. So it imploded, and we thought really the immigration debate was going to be gone for the rest of the year, but it's been popping up in fits and starts ever since.
So as it stands today, then, what are the laws that guide immigration? If this bill imploded, as you say, we're back to a bill that was written a number of years ago then.
We are. We're back to the immigration law of the land as was written through bills in 1996 and in 1986 and before. So basically, being in the country illegally is still a civil penalty. It's still an administrative offense. And, you know, there's been ramped up border enforcement and border control since then. Building of a wall at the border, adding of thousands of Border Patrol agents, but the law itself still remains the same.
Well, let's talk about the DREAM Act, as it's called, the Development, Relief, and Education for Alien Minors Act. This is a bill proposed by Senator Richard Durbin, Democrat of Illinois. What does this bill say?
This bill basically would allow illegal immigrants who came here under the age of 16 and have lived in the United States for at least 5 years and have graduated from high school or have a GED to basically get conditional legal residence in this country. They would receive a document that would allow them to live here for 6 years, and if during that time period they either, one, went to college and got a two-year degree or were on track to get a four-year degree or entered the military and served at least 2 years in the military, they then could get a green card and ultimately become citizens.
And how long, I mean, if this were to pass, how long would it take then for these people to become citizens?
Well, from beginning to end, you're looking at 6 years of conditional status, and you're looking at getting the green card. And for most people who get a green card, you have to wait 5 years before filing for citizenship. So you're looking at potentially an 11, 12-year process.
Now, Senator Durbin has introduced this bill before. Is that right?
That is true. This bill has been pending in Congress in one form or another since 2001. And though not hugely controversial in the earlier years of its introduction, just never managed to pass both houses of Congress at the same time.
And why do you think that is?
You know, it's just the legislative process. I mean, you attach something to one bill in the Senate, and it doesn't get introduced in the same version on the House side. It was not a high priority in the earlier years for anybody other than the immigrant rights community and some educational groups, and though certainly well-liked, didn't have a huge amount of emphasis put on it on a legislative fast track. It's obviously gained a lot more prominence now, particularly with the fact that this comprehensive immigration reform bill died earlier this year in the Senate.
Now, this is attached to a defense bill, right?
Well, that's what Senator Durbin is trying to do. He's hoping to bring it up this week. I talked to him on Thursday, and he was telling me he knows he's going to have to get 60 votes. I mean, anything that is of any controversy in the Senate basically requires 60 votes to avoid a filibuster, and at this point, he does not have the 60 50 votes, so he was hoping to round those up. And if he's successful in doing that, we'll try and attach it to the defense bill this week.
But is it fair to say that the Democrats would support this, Republicans might not, or is it a more mixed picture than that?
He has a lot of Republican co-sponsors, so I think it's not fair to call it just a partisan effort. He definitely has a lot of Republican support on this. The question is just whether he's got enough to get to that, you know, all-important 60 number.
What's the response from the Defense Department been on this proposed bill?
There have been individual Defense Department officials who have spoken on this and who definitely would like the fact, you know, particularly at a time right now where the military is stretched in Iraq and Afghanistan and they've had some difficulty in earlier months meeting their recruiting benchmarks, certainly to have a huge new pool of applicants, and not only applicants, but well-qualified applicants who've graduated from high school, who've passed a criminal background check and don't have any difficulties in their backgrounds. For them, I think this is obviously something that they would like to do.
And what about groups that support rights for illegal immigrants? How do they view a bill like this?
They very much support this bill. This bill is backed by everybody from the National Council of La Raza and the other major Hispanic rights groups to the Catholic Church, to a lot of labor and business organizations. So certainly on that side of the spectrum, this is something that they very much want.
And what about the Lou Dobbs crowd? They're going to view this.
Well, interestingly, because, you know, in prior years, as I mentioned, when this came up through Congress, this did not generate a lot of heat and controversy. But this year, the same groups that mobilized to take down the comprehensive immigration reform bill earlier this year are agitating and sending hundreds of thousands of faxes and calls and emails and bombarding members of Congress, telling them to derail what they view as a backdoor amnesty.
In fact, I'm looking at something that Dan Stein, president of the Federation for American Immigration Reform Fair, he says the DREAM Act, that's what we're talking about, amounts to a massive amnesty under the guise of being sympathetic to kids. Unfortunately, sympathy for one group of illegal aliens would come at a huge cost to other people's children, who would have to give up their opportunities for a taxpayer-funded higher education in order to accommodate illegal aliens. And then he goes on from there. And I guess that's really their argument against this particular bill.
They do. They have sort of a threefold argument. One, it's an amnesty. Two, you're depriving Americans of taxpayer-funded college benefits. And three, you're sort of disproportionately affecting people who are here in this country legally who are non-citizens, but who themselves do not have access to the same level of benefits that this would confer.
But do you think this argument from these groups is going to prevail as it has in the past?
You know, it's very interesting. I mean, there is a huge amount of pressure being put right now on particularly Republican senators. I mean, look at somebody like John Cornyn from Texas, a Texas Republican. He voted for the DREAM Act in the Senate Judiciary Committee a few years ago and previously supported it. And now he sort of is on the fence about this and not saying where he's going to be, well, in part because the legislation has been sort of redrafted a little bit. But there's a lot of pressure being placed on people like him.
Well, let me just quickly reintroduce you, Michelle, and I'm also interested from our listeners whether you would support a bill that would allow the children of undocumented immigrants to become citizens either through military service or college. It's a bill that has been introduced in the past before by Senator Richard Durbin, Democrat of Illinois, and apparently he's going to reintroduce it sometime soon. Michelle Mittelstadt is our guest. She's a congressional reporter for the Houston Chronicle, and she does cover immigration policy for the Houston Chronicle, and joins us this morning on Radio Times. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. What do you think about this bill? It's called the DREAM Act. Michelle, you mentioned other bills that have been bubbling up. What else is making its way across Congress as they get into session this year?
Well, the next big thing that's coming up, and we'll do so in the Senate, is a bill called Ag Jobs. And agriculture interests have been pressing for this dramatically for a number of years, but increasingly in the last year or two, because as border control and border security have been ramped up at the southwest border, it's become harder for people to come across. And most of the workers in the agricultural fields are actually undocumented immigrants or illegal immigrants. Something like 70 to 80% of all farm workers are illegal immigrants. And so as the border has become tighter, it's become harder for U.S. Agriculture to find workers. And so this bill introduced by Senator Dianne Feinstein of California essentially would allow over its five-year life about 1.5 million illegal immigrants who are willing to work in the fields for a number of years to get an initial sort of conditional legal status and then eventually get green cards and potentially citizenship.
Is this kind of a temporary workers program revisited?
Well, yes, except it's more than temporary because you're not asking these people to go home at the end of their work period. And in fact, the Republicans, some Republicans, conservatives in the Senate are sort of trying to draft an alternative of their own that would actually make it a temporary worker program and would be along the lines of you come into the United States and you work for 10 months of the year and then you leave and return, go back to your country and then can reapply to come back in. So it would appear, this will probably come up in October when the Senate debates the farm bill, but this certainly would be significantly more controversial and contentious than even the DREAM Act because this is a much larger program and has much bigger implications, and certainly the groups that oppose illegal immigration really view this as a major amnesty.
But it does show, at least the way our economy is structured today, how dependent we are on illegal immigration, especially when it comes to things like farming and food and agriculture.
Absolutely. In the agriculture sector, you know, as I mentioned, I mean, the workforce there is huge. And already you've had growers from across the country complaining that they've had crops rotting in the fields and that they're unable to make, you know, harvesting and planting decisions for the coming seasons because they don't know if the labor's going to be there. Senator Feinstein, for example, is saying that already a lot of growers in California are basically offshoring their production. They're moving to Mexico, they're renting land in Mexico, and they're basically starting to produce there. And she and others are questioning whether this is really in the national and economic security of this country to basically be sending its food production elsewhere.
Interesting. Well, let me get some callers in the conversation. And we have Joe from the Southwest joining us. Hi, Joe. Go ahead. Your Radio Times.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Good. Thank you.
And I was just wondering where the unions were coming down on the DREAM Act, because it seems to me that they should be coming down on this on the side of the anti-illegal immigration, because I'm a union member, I'm a pro-choice Democrat, but when it comes to illegal immigration, it seems to me that because they help to drive wages down, it would negatively affect the American worker. And because we just got the minimum wage raised in the first 100 hours of the Democratic Congress who took charge in 2006, I was just wondering how the unions were responding to it. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
No, Joe, thanks for the call to Radio Times. It's a good question. Michelle, go ahead.
Yeah, it is a good question. You actually do have union groups, for example, like SEIU, the Service Employees International Union, which has endorsed the DREAM Act. You have the American Federation of Teachers, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. So there definitely are union groups out there that do support this. And I think their contention is these children are already in the country. They came here through no fault of their own. They committed no illegality in and of themselves. This was the decision by their parents. They're here. They've been educated in U.S. schools. And why not sort of achieve the full benefit so that they can be fully productive members of the society?
Which I guess is a different argument, looking at illegal immigrants working today in whether it's in construction or agriculture, that unions are concerned about.
Right. Well, you know, there's actually a bit of a rift in the union movement over how to approach illegal immigration and what to do. You've had the AFL-CIO, for example, which has been greatly concerned about a temporary worker program for the reasons that Joe has mentioned, that, you know, it does take away or it adds competition for the U.S. worker and in some cases has depressed wages, you know, throughout U.S. sectors of the economy. On the other hand, you have newer unions such as SEIU, which are very immigrant heavy in terms of the workers that they have, who very much are agitating for legalization, for the DREAM Act, and for all of these programs that you're seeing. So it's sort of a question of the more old guard unions versus the newer ones that potentially are having more of an increase in membership right now and maybe where more of the energy and activity is.
Let me get Pedro from Newark, Delaware, to join us. Hi, Pedro. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, yes, man. Thank you very much. Well, my point is that I know some people that have been here in this country for 15 years paying taxes, employment authorization cards, and I know a lot of people, especially people that come from El Salvador. The system has not allowed them after all these 15 years to get a permanent resident. I don't know how really the system completely works, but it seems to me that it's kind of broken. And the people that keep making the argument that, you know, the illegal immigrants, you know, either take away, you know, money for education or also, you know, bring the wages down. I have been working in many industries, a couple industries. And my experience is that people that have come to work and they are legally or legally, they actually do a pretty good job, and the companies that hire them, they're always in need of hiring people. I always see, advertisement of employment offering, you know, help wanted. And I don't know where they come with this argument that there is no jobs, you know, opening, or that they are bringing the wages down.
All right, Pedro, I appreciate the call to Radio Times and Michelle Mittelstadt. It seems, and we've done a number of shows about illegal immigration, and, you know, it seems we come back to the same sort of essential set of either issues or disagreements about what it does or doesn't do for the country.
Exactly, and that's why it makes it such a tough issue to deal with politically, because I think, as you saw from your earlier callers, I mean, Joe was mentioning the concerns about lost jobs and depressed wages, and Pedro was talking about the gains that immigrants are making and the fact that the jobs do appear to be there for them to do. So that sort of neatly encapsulates really the difficulty
Indeed.
And the dilemma of this issue.
Let me get to Elliot. Pedro, thanks for the call. Let me get Elliot from North Philadelphia to join us. Hi, Elliot. Go ahead.
Yeah, I have a question. I want to know if the people that are opposing this proposal have their own solution to the issue. Are they planning to send back? Do they want to send back these millions of kids back to their country? I'm wondering if they have another solution, being that they're against this.
Okay, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Michelle, from your reporting, the folks that are opposed to either this bill or some of the other bills, what is their solution to the immigration problem?
Well, groups like Numbers USA or Federation for American Immigration Reform and some of these other groups that are out there, their solution basically is enforce U.S. law. And their point is, if you enforce the laws at the border and in the interior of the country and make it much harder for illegal immigrants to have jobs, what's going to happen is that these people are essentially going to self-deport. They will remove themselves from the country as conditions become more difficult, as it's harder for them to get jobs, as it's harder for them to make a living, and they will return to their home countries.
Let me get Elliot from North. Charles from Mineral, Virginia, to join us. Charles, we're almost out of time, but go ahead.
All right.
Hi there.
I'd like to answer something that I heard a minute ago, where this fellow was saying, "Well, there are always jobs available," and the other fellow was saying, "Well, they're taking our jobs."
Right.
Well, here's why there's always jobs available, because these companies don't have to do anything to keep people happy. They don't have to do anything to keep people, because there's a steady supply of people that will do something for very little, that'll do the worst jobs for almost nothing. And it's employers offloading their costs onto communities. You know, they won't pay a living wage, so somebody has to make up that shortfall.
And Charles,
they won't pay for health care. Well, somebody has to buy that health care.
No, I hear you. And we're almost out of time. And I just want to give Michelle Mittelstadt.
You want a solution to this thing?
Well, we're almost.
Enforce the laws.
Okay.
And you set up labor camps. If they're caught here twice, you send them to a labor camp.
Okay. Let me get Michelle to respond to your comments. Michelle, is that an idea that you've heard?
Certainly not the labor camps part of it. I mean, the enforcement part that Charles was mentioning is definitely what some of the groups that are in favor of stricter enforcement, and that's their solution to deal with the illegal immigration problem, are advocating exactly. It is interesting. I mean, when you look at the different sectors right now where you have had a high concentration of immigrant labor in construction, for example, as the construction market has softened a bit, you're seeing people transitioning out of that sector right now. And I was talking to somebody in agriculture. You had people who had left agriculture, which is a backbreaking job, and gone into construction, which generally pays better, who are now returning to agriculture as the construction jobs are starting to dry up a little bit. So it's a fascinating issue.
Well, indeed it is. And Michelle, as always, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Great to join you, Marty.
And that's Michelle Mittelstadt. She covers immigration policy and Congress for the Houston Chronicle. And coming up, we'll be shifting gears again, talking about whether ABC News got duped and published fake stories on its news. We'll be right back.
1812 Productions, Philadelphia's all-comedy theater company, supports WHYY and presents The Search for Signs of Intelligent Life in the Universe, starring Jennifer Childs in an array of roles, from jocks to supermoms to Trudy the Bag Lady. The Search for Signs of Intelligent Life in the Universe is a classic comedy about staying in touch in a disconnected world. Through October 28th, tickets at 215-592-9560 or 1812productions.org.
The news coverage around the second anniversary of Hurricane Katrina has subsided, but the challenges to rebuilding New Orleans continue. The city has the highest murder rate in the country, and the legal system has made some reforms but continues to be overwhelmed. On the next Justice Talking, the state of criminal justice in the Crescent City.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
On the next Fresh Air, Kayville, we meet Anthony Anderson, who stars as a detective on the new Fox TV drama set in post-Katrina New Orleans. Also stand-up comedian and Daily Show contributor Dimitri Martin. He's got a new DVD called Person. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Listeners are probably familiar with the names Jason Blair and Stephen Glass, who wrote fake news stories while working as journalists. But do you know who Alex DeBot is? He's being investigated for interviews he claimed he did with Barack Obama, Nancy Pelosi, Alan Greenspan, Kofi Annan, and others that apparently never took place. There are also questions about his credentials and affiliations. Laura Rosen has been covering this story. She's national security correspondent for Mother Jones Magazine and a contributor to the Washington Monthly. Good morning, Laura Rosen.
Good morning.
And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. When did you become aware of Alex DeBot?
Well, I've known, seen DeBot, on a couple of occasions in Washington at various think tank events and social occasions. He's a pretty well-known analyst in the think tank community in Washington on terrorism-related issues.
Now, he's a Frenchman, yes?
He's from France, yes, he is.
He's from France. And when did he begin working for ABC?
He began working for ABC shortly after the September 11th terrorist attacks. ABC tells me that after September 11th, they sent a team to Paris to chase down the story of Zacharias Moussaoui. That's one of the people who'd been in custody in Minneapolis, who'd been trying to learn how to fly. And there was he was a French citizen. And they said that they saw DeBot on television in France as a, intelligence expert, and that they, eventually signed him up as a consultant to help advise them on terrorism-related issues.
So what kinds of stories did he then consult on?
He worked on stuff on Al-Qaeda, stuff on Moussaoui. He was sent by ABC at least three times to Pakistan to actually work almost as a reporter, buying video, talking to his own sources in the Pakistani government and in the tribal areas. One of the more high-profile stories that DeBot contributed to in the spring at ABC alleged that the U.S. government had been backing an Iranian ethnic minority group to attack the Iran regime. And that is the story, I will say, that in the community of people like myself who follow policy to Iran, that really caught a lot of people's attention because it would indicate that the U.S. was essentially backing regime change in Iran. And I know that ABC has now sent a team of reporters and producers to Pakistan to try to find DeBot's sources there, check out that he met with the people he said he did, and see if they can still stand by the work that he contributed to.
Now, is he part of a team at ABC working on these stories?
I think his main affiliation was working for the Brian Ross Investigative Unit at ABC, which is, the high-profile investigative unit at ABC. One thing that some sources inside ABC have told me that they find troubling about the situation of DeBot at ABC is that though he was signed on as an expert consultant, the way they have some ex-government officials as, on retainer as consultants for the network, in case there's a war or some terrorism attack, they can get those people at short notice to appear on their stations and, give the audience, high expert analysis. DeBot had that role, and he was sort of being used as a reporter. It kind of crossed the line. He also, had several other paid affiliations. He was an analyst at a think tank in town called the Nixon Center until he was dismissed a couple weeks ago for these allegations of fabricating interviews. And he also, I reported last week, was indirectly working on a Pentagon contract, actually, to provide analysis concerning radical Islam.
And this was the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessment?
Correct.
That he was working for?
They had a Pentagon contract, and they hired Dabbat as a consultant again. So, you know, while he's working as an ABC reporter, and this would be ABC's decision, not Dabbat's, you know, he had a lot of affiliations. This is beyond the question of whether the information he was providing was correct or not.
And this idea that you'd have a consultant who would also be a source for stories, do you think that's unusual in the world of journalism?
In TV news, I'm learning that it's not unusual that you have paid experts on retainer, that, you know, they offer exclusivity to your network, you know, to provide analysis when needed. Sometimes those people do go out with a team of producers and reporters to, say, another country to help advance the reporting. But I think it is unusual in the case of Dabbat that they really were basically letting him work as a reporter, producer at times, and also that he would be sometimes in stories as kind of an expert analyst on the subjects of his expertise.
Now, ABC has conducted its own internal investigation. How far have they gotten, and what are they saying?
So they actually dismissed Dabbat back in June before the other places became aware of problems with his CV. They had obtained indications that his CV was exaggerated. They did a perfunctory investigation at the time that consisted, as I understand, of just making sure the stories he contributed to had a second source.
Mm.
When the questions came up the past couple weeks of whether he had misrepresented conducting interviews for a French magazine with high-profile people like Hillary Clinton, they started a new investigation. This is more extensive. They sent three people to Pakistan to, you know, with his business cards, essentially. He's cooperating with the investigation. And they, so far I've heard from ABC officials that his information is checking out. Mm-hmm. I will say that, and this is where ABC and I think officials and I would disagree, there are people inside who think that they needed to open up their investigation a bit more. It's being very closely held. They are not turning to other reporters at the network outside of the Brian Ross investigative unit and their editorial standards VP to do the investigation. For instance, there are guys at the Pentagon, at the State Department, there are reporters in the region. It's being conducted by people who may have an interest in saying, okay, we checked it out and we can still stand by this work.
And you've talked to people working at ABC who have raised some of these questions about its own internal investigation?
Correct. It's actually very high stakes for ABC, and I think that they're very concerned to, you know, their credibility is very important to them. But Dabbat, through intermediaries and ABC, both seem to be thinking that they will be able to say that his information did check out.
You know what I find interesting, and I know that on the media yesterday did an interview with you about this story, but, you know, I've looked high and low. Besides what you're doing, Laura, I haven't seen a lot of coverage on this story. And yet, of course, the Jason Blair story got a lot of press. So did Stephen Glass, some of these other stories of journalists faking the news. Why do you think this is still a bit under the radar?
It's such a good question. I know that, you know, the Washington Post has done a couple stories, as has the New York Times. I think that it's partly delicate when big media companies are dealing with other big media companies, that at that level there is a kind of collegiality. You know, a lot of people are interconnected. I don't know if there's a conflict of interest angle on the story, to tell you the truth, that I don't suffer from, because those people are, you know, not working at a much higher level than I'm working at.
Don't say that, Laura.
It's being treated a little bit as a media story and not just as a national security story. And I think it has elements of both. So it's good if you can poke around the actual substance of the stories he reported, like I've tried to do. I think that's not how media reporters tend to cover things.
And would you say, from your poking around, I mean, yes, there are some questions, certainly serious questions about his credentials and the sort of dual responsibilities that he had for ABC, but from your reporting, should any of his stories be challenged and even called fake at this point?
I think it's really hard unless ABC is willing to explain who his sources were, which I think they will be very reluctant to do, because they'll say these are confidential sources of his from Pakistan. It's going to be very hard to say that someone did not tell him something. You know, the people he talked to in Pakistan are not Barack Obama with a spokesman who you can easily access and say, did you do this interview? So I think, you know, there'll be those of us who may be troubled no matter what ABC comes back and says. I think that's part of it.
Sure. And do you think, I mean, from your perspective, should an outsider look at this instead of just ABC investigating itself?
Well, I think one sort of middle ground option would be for ABC to get draw in more of its own reporters and people from outside of that unit to re-report his stuff. You know, can they get their own excellent reporters to basically see if this stuff checks out? They have lots of experienced people. And I think that would be a way for ABC to say, you know, we've kept all of his confidential sources inside of the network.
Have you talked to Alex DeBott?
I've been in email contact a bit in the past 2 weeks, and he's provided some written communications to some policy lists in town where he insists that he's going to be vindicated. He said he made a mistake in using an intermediary for the Barack Obama interview, but none of us have been able to locate that person. And today I read in a local student newspaper at George Washington University that he's planning on suing the alleged intermediary who allegedly conducted this interview with Barack Obama that Obama's people say did not happen.
And just to pick up on that piece of the story, he says that he conducted an interview with Barack Obama and it was published in a French newspaper or magazine?
A French kind of foreign affairs type journal called Politique Internationale. And it was one of maybe 10 interviews that DeBott conducted, said he signed with high profile people. Those people have actually told ABC they did not give DeBott those interviews. DeBott has indicated through friends and contacts that the editor of that magazine may have colluded with him in faking those interviews.
Now, there's a French journalist who I guess also has been in looking at this, Pascal Richet?
Yes, Pascal Richet is the former Libération correspondent here in Washington who started a kind of online journal in France called Rue 89, and they actually broke this whole story 2 weeks ago and are still on it and are actually checking out a lot of stories that DeBott actually worked on.
I mean, it seems the height of chutzpah to say you've done an interview with Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, I mean, some of these more well-known people, to say you've done an interview if you haven't done an interview and it gets published.
You know, that's what struck me is, you know, if I had wondered at various points, you know, is he finally just going to put out a statement and, you know, kind of admitting some things and then disappear? But that is not what has happened. He's still around. He's been dismissed from many of these posts, but he still has some supporters who say they think he's going to be vindicated. Hmm. And now he's threatening, you know, lawsuits against this French editor and this Chicago alleged journalist who conducted the Obama interview. So he does have a lot of chutzpah.
And you're looking for this Chicago alleged interviewer?
Well, I talked to someone who has the same name and a similar profile in Chicago who does not know DeBott. Hmm. Has interviewed Obama for his AM radio show in Chicago. So it seems like there's an element of reality to even the things that are exaggerated, which is something that others have found with DeBott's CV as well. He did, for instance, go to the Sorbonne in France. He did not obtain a PhD, which is what he put on his CV. Do you understand? So there's always an element of truth. You know, he was a desk officer at the French Ministry of Defense for 8 to 10 months. You know, ABC described him as a former French defense official for the past 6 years. So it's not like everything is totally pulled from thin air.
But at the same time, I mean, it raises a whole host of questions, one including the vetting process that goes for people hired either as consultants or as sources.
No, absolutely. I mean, that no one called to get to check his diploma from the Sorbonne. You know, apparently various institutes he claimed to be a director of have gotten in touch in the past with some of his places here and said that he's not been exactly what he said, but no one pulled the plug until ABC dismissed him in June.
And it makes you wonder whether if someone works at the, as he did at the Nixon Center as Director of National Security Programs, with that on your resume, then chances are, or I guess there's a good chance, then you get hired to work in some other prestigious
think tank
without the vetting that goes on.
I think that's right.
What are you looking for now? I mean, it sounds like there are many strands to the story.
Well, one thing I am looking at is ABC's investigation. I mentioned before, I think that there is a reason that some of the bigger newspapers won't poke that story too hard, and the people they tend to talk to at the network are the higher-level people who are trying to say they've got it under control, the bots information is checking out. You know, yes, they're very mad at him, but on the one hand, everything he gave us is great, which may be true, but I think that's the area where I'm trying to understand why they haven't opened up the investigation a little bit more.
And have you talked to Brian Ross? As you say, he was involved in his unit, his investigative unit at ABC.
I've talked to Ross last Saturday, and he was very generous with his time. And as he told the New York Times a couple weeks ago, DeBot brought them great information, and he said that the information has checked out. DeBot threw himself in several stories, he said, that were in front of several stories that were wrong. So he still seems to think that DeBot really helped them.
Hmm. What are the lessons of this story, Laura?
Well, one is, I do think, as I mentioned earlier, that I think the whole idea of consultants in the news business, you know, it's one thing if they're segregated a little bit as expert analysts who may have conflicts of interest and an agenda. I think it's important not to always blur the line between you know, reporters who are ostensibly working just to get the truth and those who have lots of paid affiliations. That's one thing I think that networks should take from this beyond the question of, you know, it's hard to protect yourself from outright fabricators, I guess, in your midst. The other thing I will say is that I've had sources who've come to me in the past who've had very, you know, said, you know, they don't believe DeBot is exactly what he says he is. I am a bit surprised that all these high-profile institutions he worked for hadn't heard the same thing in the past.
And raising questions about either their vetting process or their willingness to sign up somebody of dubious credentials.
Yeah, just becoming invested, I guess, in believing that this person has great access and that, you know, one does become seduced by that, the person who tells you they can get you great access.
And, of course, this leaves the public, you know, I mean, the public should know where their information is coming from and who's responsible for it.
Correct. Yeah, I agree.
Well, Laura, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome. Okay. And bye-bye. And she's a national security correspondent for Mother Jones Magazine, a contributor to the Washington Monthly. And she's been covering the story about a source, Alex DeBot, questions raised about his credentials and his work with ABC News and some other organizations. Well, that's it for this first hour of Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and find out more about the program. I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to WHYY-FM Philadelphia, your member-supported news and information station serving Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware.